Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the education channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom DeSena, from the Department of Communication, Journalism, and Public Relations at Oakland University. My guest today is Renyi Hong, the author of Passionate Work, Endurance After the Good Life. In Passionate Work, Renyi Hong theorizes the notion of being passionate about your work as an affective project that encourages people to endure economically trying situations like unemployment, job change, repetitive and menial labor, and freelancing. Not simply a subject of aspiration, passion has been deployed as a means to build resilience and mend disappointment with our experiences of work. Tracking the rise of passion in 19th century management to trends like gamification, co-working, and unemployment insurance, Hong demonstrates how passion can emerge in instances that would not typically be understood as passionate. Gamification numbs crippling boredom by keeping call center workers in an unthinking, suspensive state, pursuing even the most banal tasks in hope of career advancement. Co-working spaces, marketed towards freelancers, combat loneliness and disconnection at the precise moment when middle-class sureties are profoundly threatened. Ultimately, Hong argues the ideal of passionate work sustains a condition of cruel optimism in which passion is offered as the solution for the injustices of contemporary capitalism. Renyi Hong is an assistant professor in the Department of Communication and New Media at the National University of Singapore. He is interested in labor and its relationships with affect, technology, and capitalism. His works can be found in Social Texts, New Media and Society, and the European Journal of Cultural Studies, among others. Renyi Hong, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, honored to be here. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for taking the time to talk today. I know we're dealing with quite a big time gap with me being in the Eastern time zone of the U.S. and you there in Singapore, but also I want to thank you for your work on this really important topic. The problem that you're grappling with in this book has become endemic. There are a number of titles out in the last few years that grapple with our emotional investments in work. I'd like to ask, to start, what brought you to this project? That is, what got you interested in the issue of passionate work?
Right. So, I mean, what initially brought me to this topic was just an observation, right, of how passion was so sort of something that people spoke about all the time, right, when they were starting to look for work, when they're in work, when they feel disappointed by their work, like it just comes up all the time, right? But I was also looking at this project, doing this project sometime after the Great Recession. So it was quite obvious that at a period of time, there was this contradiction, right? Although there was this, you know, sort of the do what you love kind of discourse going on, at the same moment, right, there was also a deep skepticism about passion, right? I think people were just jaded and overwhelmed by the job hunting process. And this is when I was starting to look into it and, you know, sort of thinking about what passion really does, right? And I guess, you know, a lot of the literature, right, speaks of passion in sort of a more narrow way, I would presume, right? So passion was is what I called a trade-off thesis, right? That basically people can be exploited for their passion, right? By being given lower wages and things like that. And I wanted to expand the ways we taught about passion, right, as ideological kind of formation.
Well, so let's start there. And kind of defining some of these key terms. What exactly is it that we mean by passionate work?
Right. So I define it a little bit differently from how most people define it. So I guess for most people, passion is a feeling, right? It's something that you experience, right? And you engage in, or you want passionate work because you want a particular feeling or a particular encounter with work. For me, I see passionate work as a real ideological formation. In other words, you don't need to feel passion to encounter the ideological nature of passionate work, right? So for instance, your work may be adjusted, right, to fight against, say, boredom without you experiencing passion itself, right? So more specifically then, what passion is and I define it against other emotions, but passion is a feeling that is characterized by its energeticity, right? It is a very energetic emotion, right? Because it gets you to do something. And this is actually an interesting, I think, a way of defining a particular emotional or affective state, because what it means is that you don't actually need to be happy to be passionate, right? So a passionate person can actually be overwhelmed, can actually be fatigued, right? And still be passionate. And also quite interestingly, a person who is passionate is most defined by failure. In other words, you know, when a person continues acting, even when they're overwhelmed, that is oftentimes the clearest example, the clearest evidence that a person is what we would not commonly describe as passionate.
So it might seem odd to ask this question today, as the idea of doing what you love or being passionate about your work is almost taken as axiomatic in our culture. But how did the idea of passionate work emerge as a necessary component of living a good life?
Right. And I think we can trace back to especially the 1950s. I think one of the biggest sort of speakers about this was Abraham Maslow, right? When he talked about self-actualization being the sort of apex of human fulfillment, right? What all humans really want. That was, I think, critical in sort of giving the rationale that passion is something, finding excitement in what you do, being interested in what you do, is actually key towards, being fulfilled as a human being, right? It's a very humanist logic to this. Of course, we can take that and trace it back to, I think, you know, the romantic work ethic. You know, I think other scholars have done that too. But I think the 1950s is really this moment where a lot of different theorists, you know, Douglas MacGregor, you know, and other different managerial theorists are coming up to sort of use passion as a way of defining what the new emotional regime in capitalism was going to be, right? And by the 1970s, this was really naturalized, right? And it was naturalized not just by managers, but by journalists and, public intellectuals. And the basic argument was that passion was something, is something we all seek. It's something inherent in our human DNA that we want. And that only in finding it and doing what you love can you feel fulfilled and happy in your life's adventures.
It also functions as sort of a corrective, if I'm not mistaken, right? That at another level, it offers sort of a way out of the kind of Taylorist nightmare that was sort of encapsulated by factory work and its equivalent in the sort of hierarchy of the modern corporation, right?
Yeah. I mean, so passion was coming against, I would basically characterize the period before to be one of happiness, you know. So yes, there is Taylorism, right? But there's also Elton Mayo and human relations, right? And I think the general feeling at that moment, right, was that, I mean, the general push at the time was about industrial harmony and about efficiency, right? So in these two threads, right, what passion sort of is, when passion is defined against it, is really described as much more about self-fulfillment, about self-actualization than the kind of, like you mentioned, the kind of deadening quality of the sort of Taylorist requirement, but also against the sort of the stultifying quality of sometimes what people call happiness, right? So the argument at the time was happiness was like contentment. It just got you to work, but it didn't get you excited about work or excited about life. So it sort of created this sort of hollow smiles in people. And that was, I think, the key argument in the 1950s.
So I'd like to ask you to read from the book. If you could turn to the last full paragraph on page 25, I think that'll help our listeners get a sense of really the problem that you're trying to tackle here.
The cost of labor under capitalism, Marx suggests, will always have the tendency to be forced towards zero. Although the zero of labor cost is always beyond reach, capital can always approximate more and more nearly to it. Thus, in the cultural ascendance of passionate work, it is not uncommon that corporations repudiate the importance of wages, even as they affirm the deeply fulfilling life that work can offer. Problematizing feelings may not only be more cost-efficient than increasing wages, it may also be more effective in stimulating productivity, getting workers to put more of their energies into their working hours to accommodate unpaid and overtime work, and to curb threats to the smooth functioning of businesses. Leaning into the normal happy fold of corporate life aligns with capitalism's relentless search for profits.
Yeah, so I think that's just a really nice summary of some of what you're getting at here. I wonder if you'd like to elaborate a little.
Yeah, I mean, we think about passion and what passion does, right? It's a lot of times about getting people to work more, work harder, while at the same time pushing down the wages of ordinary workers, right? And I think, and this is, you know, this has started from a long time ago, and I think we really see it now with, you know, influences with people who do in wellness industries, in creative industries. You see that a lot. And I think that is one of the key problems of passion, right? And I think why people are so concerned about it and why the issues about it is so salient at this historical moment.
So in the first case study in your book, you call attention to employment's theoretical other in the condition of unemployment. Tell us a little bit about your fascinating analysis of the Marienthal studies.
Yeah, I mean, that study is interesting because I took a while to actually work on that particular chapter. And the Marienthal study, Marienthal, again, is this social scientific text that has become very influential in thinking about unemployment. And a key argument about that text is just how people, how employment, you know, how after extended periods of unemployment that people will become apathetic, right? So the sort of the emotional regulation function of employment was basically the key argument of the Marienthal text, right? And that text still continues to be cited today, right? As the sort of main argument about why employment is so important for people's mental health. What was really interesting, though, about that study when I looked at it carefully was how they defined apathy, right? I mean, when I think of apathy, I typically think of people who are depressed, right? Are fairly unhappy. But the descriptions of apathy in the Marienthal text was actually not that, right? So these were people, and this was a community, right, which was unemployed. But they defined people who were apathetic as essentially people who were contented, who had moments of sporadic joy. But I think the key problem they described was that they had no inclination to look for work. they have no inclination to find ways to become more productive, right? And the researchers later on go on to talk about the decline, especially in the communities, men, towards becoming more and more like animals. Essentially, they become instinctual. They react to sounds. They go out, they react to sounds, and then they will just stop there until a new sound prompts them, and then they sort of turn and follow that new sound. So there was something curious about the way Marintel was understanding apathy that drew me because apathy is defined as opposite of passion, right? Drew me to think about the influence of passion in understanding our condition of joblessness.
And that leads you to an analysis of the really ubiquitous advice manual, What Color Is Your Parachute? And how does this seemingly benign and really very popular bit of self-help literature contribute to our psychic investment and passionate work?
Right. I mean, What Color Is Your Parachute is a very, I think, important text to think about when you think about passion, right? Because it is also one of the most popular job hunting kind of texts, right? And it's also one of the first few texts that really sort of describe passion, right? Finding your, so they have this flower exercise, right? Where you're supposed to find the thing that you are most, you're born to do, you're most interested to do, right? So basically finding your bliss, finding your passion through that flower exercise. And the exercise is really long. It takes a long time to do that exercise. So it's some serious work, right? And so that was the first, Richard Boyles, right, the writer of What Color Is a Parachute, was the first person who really sort of made a clear case about why passion was crucial to job hunting. At the start, it was really more about, you know, that you'll just be happy, you'll be fulfilled, you know, to find what you love to do. Now, as time goes on, and in moments of unemployment especially, he would start, however, talking about it differently, right? And he would say that finding what you love to do is really, really important because that would give you the energy and the gumption to continue, you know, searching for that job, right? Even when things are tough, even when you are not getting any responses. So I think looking at Boyles and the way he, conceptualizes the centrality of passion to the job hunting experience, right? Made me realize the sort of different uses of passion, right? And especially the way passion is employed to create more resilient workers, right? To create workers who are more able to handle the problems and abuses of the job market, right? Which has only gotten worse every single year since then.
And continues
I've been researching for this for a while, and you know, it's startling how the reports about job hunting have just gotten worse and worse over time.
Yeah. So one of the more insidious ideas that you analyze goes by the name of gamification. What does this term mean, and how do you see it functioning as a form of what you call soft control?
So gamification is basically a term used by software engineers, but also marketers and managers, right? And the main idea is how they could make something that is, you know, not necessarily a game feel game-like, right? There are sort of competing definitions, right, in the community about what can be defined as gamification. For instance, can you gamify something that is not software at all, right? But essentially, the idea again is to translate something that is, typically usually boring or uninteresting or something you would not consider exciting to be something that has game-like qualities that will make it more engaging. So a common use of this, for instance, is in education. The idea is that you want to be able to motivate students to do things that they would otherwise not do, right? Now, of course, this is clearly a method of self-control. You know, this is a way of getting people to do things that they may not want to do, right? Or they may not be interested to do. Gamification in work especially is used particularly in amongst workers who oftentimes have fairly boring jobs, right? And so again, the goal here is to get them to, you know, to alleviate, I guess, relieve the tedium of work, but then also then to produce more, right? To contribute to corporate profits.
Well, so what's an example from the world of work of this idea of gamification?
Mm-hmm. So one of the more interesting things I've been looking at is the gamification of call center work, right? You can imagine, right, call center work is largely an electronic kind of work, right? That is relatively easy to gamify, right? And if you look at gamification systems, you know, it has pretty elaborate systems, right? So for instance, when you pick up a call, you will get maybe say 10 points, right? If you finish a call in 5 minutes, you get a bonus 20 points, so on, and then the points contribute to badges. You get the leaderboards, right? And basically, it gives you in a sort of competition, right? And it gives you some goals, right? How fast to finish your call and things like that, that keeps the work of, you know, call center work more interesting, right? And so, I mean, that's one of the, I think, direct applications. I think why I was so interested in gamification was the rhetoric around it, right? So, when it was discussed as kind of gamification for call center work, and it's largely discussed in humanitarian terms. In other words, it's about relieving the work of usually the people lowest in the value chain, right? And I guess, you know, if you look at the history around such work, and I think that's one interesting thing is that, you know, this kind of work is not the kinds of work that basically it's not seen as people. These are not people who would be in the sphere of passionate work, right? These are not the people you associate with what passionate work is like. And so I guess part of my interest was really thinking about how does passionate work come to affect these groups of people who typically will not be considered passionate at all. And in fact, the last group of people you would think of when you think of the word passion.
Yeah. But it's interesting that it kind of, I just done a podcast earlier in the year with someone who was doing a study on the idea of the meritocratic society. And there's something that sort of kind of dovetails nicely with this idea of gamification and the idea of a meritocracy. That is the sort of the measurement that goes into of trying to do better at your job.
I mean, definitely. I think gamification works in terms of spurring competition, right? And I think they do it quite deliberately. I mean, it is very easily. I mean, the whole process is quantified, right? And points and stuff like that. So it's very easy to see merit, at least merit in terms of who is doing something faster and stuff like that. I mean, within gamification communities, I mean, there are nuances, right? So for instance, you may not want to always incentivize people to finish their calls too quickly because that would not be good customer service, right? So how you assign points on what conditions, those are things that, you know, the software experts really sort of tinker with. But I think the meritocratic thing applies in a different way too, in a sense that what I think these workers are being shown is the possibility of participating in a system that they would otherwise be excluded from. In other words, as a call center worker, you're in a dead-end job, right? And again, it's not just call center workers, but a lot of these jobs that are being gamified, it's mostly a dead-end job, right? And so what gamification does, and they do it not just through the literal points, they also do it in a way that, you know, you can collect badges, right? And there are systems meant to sort of translate those badges into your CV that you can bring outside and then, you know, showcase so-called your diverse skill sets, right? So there are all these ways of translating a literal sort of a gamification system into something that is meant to sort of speak about the human capital, right? Again, to highlight the possibility of progression within a system or ideological system or meritocracy. But again, I mean, this is this is largely a fantasy, right? I mean, most of the time, these workers, once you are in a call center job, it's hard to leave it, you know?
Yeah, this chapter resonated with me. Here at the university, we're in the College of Arts and Sciences, and lately there's been an effort to make the arts and sciences, make the liberal arts, quote unquote, relevant. And one of the methods that our leadership has decided on to do that is to offer students badges. Really almost exactly the way that you're describing them, for, you know, taking certain courses or encountering certain ideas, and then they get this thing that they presumably put on their CV that they have a badge in, you know, critical thinking or something like that.
Right. You know, I mean, I sometimes wonder how to think about this, you know. I mean, I do think that, I think for the students, if I were to, I mean, to be more sympathetic to the students, I can really see why they are so concerned about it. I mean, they are faced with, and it goes back to that in the previous chapter about the nature of the job market. The job market itself is very trying. It is very difficult. And I think that, you know, people who are entering the job market are faced with significant stress, right? I think mental health problems have been really serious, right? I mean, in the United States, definitely, but I think around the world too, in Singapore, where I am, you know, amongst university-age students, college-age students, mental health is not good, right? And I think these kinds of pressure is really about this kind of precarity and financial insecurity that people experience these days that has huge kind of influences, huge impacts on all parts of their lives. And so I can see why people would buy into this, because again, it is an option, right? I mean, and you can package this in a bunch of different ways. The idea is that you want to create a means of capturing more skills, capturing more certifications, capturing more abilities. But again, I mean, again, it comes down to that question, right? This is the crisis of the system. There is something problematic about the system, and I guess fixing it that way would only create more pressure rather than actually, I think, alleviate it.
Oh, yeah, you're 100% correct. I mean, there's no question but that, you know, students are, especially students, as you said, the contemporary 18, 22-year-olds that we see, or although, you know, at a school like the one where I'm working, we see older students, and they're under enormous strain because, as you said, the job market has become really vicious, and they're looking for any edge that they can get. So I understand completely why they would attach themselves to this. So the last case study in your book is of a very contemporary idea of co-working. Most people will know this through companies like WeWork. For some of our listeners who may not know, what is co-working, and how, in your analysis, does it serve to advance this ideology of passionate work?
Right. So co-working is, it's basically a new use of real estate space, essentially, that sort of took off recently in a very popular way. The basic idea here is that usually an office space will be converted into a place that you can rent and to work in it. Right, so you pay to work in a space. Now there have been satellite offices of particular sorts, you know, before co-working. But I think what the modern moment of co-working does is that they sort of really take an effort to make it not just about space but about culture. So and I think this sort of varies. I think WeWork is one version of it, right? And in the WeWork version, essentially you have a very curated space, and people can come in there. They will pay a certain sum of money, and they could have nice drinks, have a nice space, and they can bring clients in. And the idea also is that that you'll be able to network. So you'll be able to network with people who are like-minded, who are also freelancers, and then you can collaborate to build your own business and build your brand and things like that. That is the promise of co-working. So I came to co-working really out of an interest in infrastructure. I'm interested in infrastructural work, which is, so I've been looking into the sort of architecture and offices and things like that for prior to passionate work, right? And one of the iterations, of course, was co-working, right? And it just struck me about how co-working was so much about the endorsement of passion in a particular way. So it's about how you could bring people, who are freelancers, who are lonely, who are probably feeling defeated and, alienated, and they can put them in a space where it's vibrant and full of like-minded people of their own tribe, and that they would just flourish, right? And in extreme version, I opened this story with a sort of Clive Wilkinson sort of imagination, right, of the endless office. And Clive Wilkinson sort of developed the Googleplex, right? But in the endless office, it's just this office that is stretched above London, and you can just take an elevator up and you'll reach it, the kind of thing. And it's just fascinating how infrastructure is imagined as a new way where people can sort of come into more positive encounters with work.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
And your work in this chapter is largely ethnographic. So tell us a little about your experiences of sort of occupying these spaces.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, so I ended up going to a number of co-working spaces, especially in the West, or coastal West of America, right? And honestly, at first, I struggled to make sense of it. I mean, I could I could speak about, say, the architecture or the sort of interiors of a space, which will, usually taste well designed. But I was expecting a lot more vibrancy, and people were just working inside, people were just minding their own business and working inside. And so that got me a bit disoriented for a while, because it was not exactly what I thought I would see. And of course, having spoken to other people who are, co-working, right, who are co-workers, they just told me that, of course, you're here to work, you won't go around and speak to everybody, and there are some occasions where you do speak to people. But I did come to realize that what was offered here, I mean, the sort of the marketed speech is that this gives you sociality, right, and you find your tribe and stuff like that. What most people get out of it is not really that kind of sociality. It's a more, I think it's a more lightweight, more, I guess, they're just like acquaintances. Like, they literally just want people to work next to them, because sometimes that motivates them, that keeps them accountable, right? And that also serves a small degree of feeling like you are not alone as a freelancer. And I think that matters to people.
Can you go a little bit deeper into that? Because I'm just fascinated by that idea. I'm thinking back to my first sabbatical as a full-time faculty member, and I was told by all of my senior colleagues that whatever I do, no matter what, I should not set foot on campus, right? Just stay away from this place, and so. I don't do the kind of work that requires travel, and I didn't have to be any place. So I was mostly at home. And so I would go to a coffee shop, and every day I would, pack up my computer, and I would go to this coffee shop, and I would spend 8 hours, tapping away at my computer and doing my sabbatical project. And it struck me that this was very much the same kind of thing. And eventually, that sort of light, accountability or whatever, however you described it, it got really trying. And so on subsequent sabbaticals, I've just gone into the office because at least there are people here who I like and can talk to.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, So I guess what I found with, and I speak a lot about that because, there has been this big discourse around the loneliness epidemic, all right, in the United States, but also broadly, I think, worldwide. Part of it is what exactly is loneliness? And I try to dive into that question in that chapter, right? And for me, I mean, yes, so loneliness is a feeling, right? It's a feeling of being isolated from people, right? But if you go back to Marx and you go to Arendt, right? What loneliness actually is about feeling redundant and sort of outside, mechanisms that allow you to produce economic value, right? And so I started thinking through that aspect, and again, freelancing is one of those jobs that while you are, most freelancers sort of do it on their own, you actually need a group of people to help you out along because, there are just too many problems, right? How do you know you're doing a good job? What if you need to collaborate on something? What if you need help, if you need assistance, right? And I think a lot of freelancers just tell me, when they work alone, without anyone to look out for them to, that they can speak to, it just felt really hard. Like they just, even if they were doing a good job, they just felt uncertain about their economic value. They felt uncertain about the work they did. They second-guessed themselves a lot more. And so I guess that got me thinking a lot about what co-working is, right? On the one hand, co-working is a promise, right? I mean, it's marketed speech is about, coming to a cool place and really building deep friendships with people of your tribe and stuff like that. In reality, what people want is something much less grandiose, I think. They just want to be in a place that keeps them away from the anxiety, all right? From perhaps feeling redundant, right? So that they know where they place, they know what they can do, right? And I think co-working is that, and sort of the infrastructure and the sociality here then sort of intersects, right? Because some co-workers told me they have been in coffee shops before, right? But they mention a lot of problems at coffee shops, right? You ultimately, the coffee shop is not really your space, right? So they have to constantly buy food. They can't leave. They can't leave their bags and go to the toilet and things like that. Yeah, these are small inconveniences, but somehow it ends up being really big for them, right? Because they just feel, again, I think, if you're doing this for a long period of time and you're going to do this for a whole career, right? Feeling that you don't have a place, I think, starts to matter because then you are just always a guest there, and so while this can work for maybe a month or two, it just starts to weigh on them once they do it for longer.
I think this is along the same lines, but I just want to tell you this. My spouse recently went back to work in the advertising business. She started her new job just after the pandemic. And so everything was remote, right? So she set up her office at home and, all of the equipment is there. And then at some point, as a lot of companies have done, there was this requirement that she go back into the office. The curious thing though for me, and I thought about this reading your chapter about co-working spaces, is that the office now has been set up along the lines of what you describe as a co-working space. So when she goes into the office, she has to reserve a spot in advance. There's no dedicated place for her. And the people who have been, sort of working remotely find this incredibly off-putting that they can't go into the office and know that there's a place for them to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's curious to me that these freelance practices, these responses to freelance practices are now starting to sort of infiltrate into, sort of regular full-time work.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they learn a lot from each other. And I think, so on the one hand, and companies can first pitch this in different ways, right? On the one hand, It could build serendipity. You know, it could get you ideas that you could get to know more people and so on and so forth, right? But I think on the other hand, it's a lot about, it's just about efficiency, about being more efficient about the use of office space, right? And actually lowering its costs, right? Because then that's what's the sort of a key driver of co-working spaces, continues to be the driver, key driver of co-working spaces that were, in fact, I think, since I've written this book, right? So a lot of, when I wrote this book, mostly people who were doing co-working were largely freelancers. Now, at least in Singapore where I'm at, the people in those co-working spaces, a lot of them are companies, right? They could be small companies, but sometimes even large companies will be in these co-working spaces. And they do it really to just reduce the sort of cost, the real estate cost, right? Office space cost that they used to have. So, I mean, a part of it is about cutting costs to and cutting costs through infrastructure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, my wife, the company, when they moved to this sort of more of a what we're describing here as a co-working model, they, of course, abandoned an entire floor of the building that they were in. So they weren't paying rent on that anymore. And also, a friend of mine, he works in London, he inhabits one of these co-working spaces. He has got a regular full-time gig, but he does everything out of a co-working space.
Mm.
So you conclude the book with some prescriptions for how workers might grapple with some of these problems of passion. Tell us a little bit about your ideas for sort of dealing with some of the issues that arise up out of your analysis.
Honestly, I struggled a lot with finding an end to the book. I mean, being critical about it, that is no problem. But how do we think about passion? For me, the way I approached it, and I understood immediately that what I did not want is the opposite of it, right? So that's something I did not want. So, you know, some people would say, okay, what are you advocating is to just not be passionate, right? To be dispassionate and stuff like that, and to be apathetic. And I just don't think that's the way to go. Because, and this happens in several grounds, because first of all, I mean, there are huge problems with, you know, simply being apathetic in the first place. But I think one of the bigger issues is that if you look at the discourses around passion, you would notice that, you know, endorsements of passion go along with critiques of it. So you might get a career guide saying, you know, don't be passionate, but find something you like, you know, or, you know, just passion will exploit you. So you got to be smart about it and just be passionate about things that don't exploit you. So basically, they sort of put you in this circle, right, essentially. And what I understood was that I just drew inspiration, I guess, from the sort of history around the term passion. Right, so passion has this very interesting somersault history. As I mentioned, passion today is one of the most active emotional states, right? In fact, it is a term, it is an affective state defined almost entirely by energy, right? By being active at something, right? But if you look historically, right, at the term, etymologically at the term, right? Passion also comes from the word pasio, which is about suffering. And suffering in a passive way. And this was, in fact, the ways that, you know, early people, people in the 18th century and before, understood emotions, right? Emotions were something that was like a spirit that afflicted you, that you had to fight it, right? And so feeling something was always not coming, it was not an emotion coming from inside, right? But it was something that came from the outside in. And I guess what was useful about understanding that was just this moment of critical reflection that a pursuit allows us, right? So my prescription for passion was not to sort of just go against passion, you know, without thinking, but actually to think about where you got that feeling, right? So instead of, you know, when someone tells you to be passionate or when you feel that, okay, this is what I'm interested in, you know, take a moment back and ask yourself, how did I come to get that feeling? For me, I think passion, that sort of approach to passion gives us a moment to think about the where we got this thing from and what we can do about it, and whether or not and what's the best way to approach our passions and approach things we like, right? And so this moment of contemplation, I think, is very necessary. And at least it's my way of trying to get a sort of give some leeway, right? To this sort of very hegemonic demand for passion in our lives.
Well, so what's an application of that? I mean, I'm thinking, especially because we're two academics sitting having this conversation, how would that sort of opening up a space to consider where the passion come from, how would that get operationalized in, for instance, work like this?
Right. Academic work is interesting because it's an interesting work, right? Because it's so much about passions, right? Especially for people who work, in departments that, are so-called losing relevance, right? Which I disagree. But, in the humanities, that is often what is said of us. But I do think that moment of contemplation is about the moment where we have to critically ask ourselves, what are obligations? And why are our passions important or unimportant? Right? Because I think passions can do a lot of different things and different kinds of, my basic question to passionate work is not what is passionate work per se, but what does passion do? And I think that, as academics, right, our passion sometimes can be very useful because it is a way of unpacking structural injustices and letting people see that there are alternatives to oftentimes a world where people think there are no alternatives and what's presented as is, right? And we are here to unpack that and to show that there are different routes. This is how things are made up and the ways that things can change. But also I think, on a personal level, I think it means being responsible to whoever we are teaching, for instance, right? For graduate students, for instance, right? When you have a graduate student, right, and given the nature of the job market, we shouldn't probably just tell them to pursue their passions, right? We have to think and we have to let them realize the reality of that situation. And that passion shouldn't be just a catchphrase to just, go ahead and do what you want to do, but there are consequences to that. And that we have an obligation to help them make the best of the situation that they are in. And I think this is one of the ways in which just thinking about our passions and what our passions can do and just being responsible for them, right, will help us, navigate this world in a much better way.
That's an excellent answer. Thank you for it. I really appreciate it. Before I let you go today, I'd like to ask what's next on your agenda? I hate to put it this way, but where are your passions leading you to next?
Yeah. So, I'm very much fascinated by labor and work. I'm actually working on the next book now, and it's titled Bearable Media. And it's basically a way of looking at different trends of digital labor, telecommuting, remote work, NFT labor, platform work, that kind of thing. And my main argument about such, when you're trying to look at such work, not about so much about their wages, right, and sort of the economic contract of work, but to think about how work transforms or is imagined to transform the people who do it. So I'm going back really here to Adam Smith, to Marx, and even to people like Norbert Wiener, who basically take a very Lamarckian kind of perspective to work, right? In other words, what you do will transform who you are. And so I'm curious to think about, and I'm curious to investigate, how do people imagine populations as transforming through work? And through my number of my different, little research projects, I found that actually work was used not just as, a kind of economic contract, but it was used to promise transformation of, families, right? Of ecologies, right? That work was used in such a big transformative way. And I guess that was, and that there was something surprising to me, right? And I'm making that the subject of my next book.
I guess I would also think that, you know, like Richard Florida's work on the creative class economy and the way that it transformed landscapes would probably factor in there as well. Well, so again, that sounds absolutely fascinating, and I hope that you'll send me a copy when you're done, and we'll have another chance for a conversation.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Okay. Renyi Hong, thank you again for taking the time to talk today. I was about to say this morning, but it's not morning for you. It's been a real pleasure to discuss this book with you.
Thank you.
Once again, my guest today has been Renyi Hong, the author of Passionate Work, From Endurance to the Good Life, from Duke University Press. My name is Tom DeSena, and you are listening to the New Books Network.